Les colloques du Collège de France.
So thank you so much, Thomas, for this invitation. It's always really good to be here. Indeed, so I'll talk about some series of work we've been doing. So I'll go try to go in the first sort of 10-15 minutes on to what's published to get to the question of cooperativity and competitiveness in development, and that's more unpublished stuff. So as a general introduction, we're interested, indeed, in the lab, a lot of our interest is on morphogenesis, but we're approaching it from a theoretical physics perspective. And one of the things we find most interesting about morphogenesis is that it's a fundamentally multiscale process, right? There's sort of 10 orders of magnitude between where the information is stored and the output of that information, so from molecules that need to self-organize into cells, that need to self-organize into organs, to end up making an actual organism. And they have to do that in spite of noise and variability. And so I think one of the questions that, one of the general questions that we look at in the group over many, many different systems is the general questions of how do cells talk to each other to collectively organize on a macroscopic length scale. And I think what's cool about, it's a fun time to ask this question because I think maybe 10 or 20 years ago, people could have said, okay, but biology is hopelessly complex and there's no way you can model it because there's nothing general about it. But I think what's cool about, again, the last sort of one or two decades of work is that we find that there's the same building blocks over and over that are present throughout development. If you look at some of the signals that pattern cells, for instance, it's a few morphogens, it's the same sort of five or six that end up popping up over and over in different systems. If you look at how tissues take their shapes, it's the same cytoskeletal components, in particular actomyosin and microtubules, that keep being reused over and over in different contexts. And even if you look at the level of cellular behaviors, it turns out that if you have, let's say, cell migration, division, apoptosis, you have a very basic grammar that can give you already a lot of complex shapes. And that's, so again, what has been sort of found in the last one or two decades. But of course, what we know from self-assembly and self-organization is that it's not enough to have the same building blocks, right? Even if you start from simple building blocks, if you change the recipe a tiny bit, you can assemble it in very different ways, right? And so you can make very different end products just by changing a little bit the instructions of these building blocks. And I think what's cool about the general questions that we're interested in now on robustness is that if you look at morphogenesis and its evolution, there's a surprising combination of versatility and precise control, right? That it's able to reconfigure these building blocks into organisms that look extremely different, but on the other hand, within one species, it's extremely reproducible and ends up doing the same thing over and over very, very precisely. So of course, it's not a new question. This is like a very, very old one. How do you end up converging in a certain species, for instance, to a specific shape? And it's something that's been asked for centuries. And I think one of the first contributions of physics into this has been one from Darcy Thompson that is over a century ago now. And there's a lot of ideas in that book, of course. But one of the ideas is that you could use physics, in more particular tissue mechanics, as a way to robustly converge towards a specific shape. That's essentially physics is a canalization mechanism that selects a few specific shapes. And again, among the many, many examples from the book of Darcy Thompson was this realization that if you look at the packing of epithelial tissues, cells look like polygonal tilings, and the angles are pretty sharp. And if you look at these kind of things, it's quite reminiscent to the physics of foams or soap bubbles, essentially. And of course, we understand why this is the case. This is because foams or soap bubbles are under surface tension. And because they're under surface tension, if you pack many of them together in 2D, for instance, they want to be hexagonal. And again, that's cool. What's cool about that is that it doesn't really matter what's the origin of the surface tension, what's the molecular control of surface tension. As long as you have a surface tension, physics is going to make you converge towards this hexagonal shape, and you get that for free. And this has been applied quite a bit, again, in the past 10 years. I like a lot this review from François Graner, for instance, for the century of Darcy Thompson's book about how this kind of idea of physics as foams can be used to understand a lot of morphology. And for instance, in addition to morphology, we also looked at whether it could explain sort of developmental variability and noise. And so, for instance, in this recent work with a group of Takeshi Iragi, we looked at the early morphogenesis of mammalian embryos, so rabbits, monkeys, and mice, and we concentrated on the 8-cell stage. And what we found, for instance, here is that if you look at the start of the 8-cell stage, it turns out that packings are extremely non-reproducible. You have all types of embryo shapes, but it turns out that at the end of the 8-cell stage, as the cells compact, as the embryos compact, you end up essentially with only one or two morphology. And it turns out that this one or two morphology is the one that is the most stable from a soap bubble perspective, is the global energy minimum from a soap bubble perspective. And we can actually reproduce the convergence, and not only the final shape, but also the developmental convergence of this kind of embryos by considering this really simple idea of essentially an embryo rolling down an energy landscape that is a physical one. Okay, but in a way, to go back to the title, this is a way where essentially mechanics tends to make you converge towards a specific shape, right? But in a way, it's a mechanics in a very basic way. It's essentially completely passive. You're saying that, soap bubbles are not living, right? And so it's a very simplified view of tissue. And if you embrace the fact that tissues are out of equilibrium material, the question is whether these kind of things hold, and can you still have mechanics, which is a canalizing factor, or can you get other feature or even the reverse? So indeed, in my group, we've been sort of very interested in the past 10 years about the fact that sort of tissues are not passive, but sort of there's a constant feedback between mechanics and biochemistry, and that there's, in particular, a number of communication between sort of cellular fates, the geometry of a tissue, and mechanics. And of course, this has a big problem of cause versus consequence. You need to understand a lot of features, because if anything can feedback on anything. But the question that you can ask in these kind of systems is, what is the role of mechanics in sort of, again, robustness of development in a system where there's a lot of potential feedbacks like this? And the system that I'm mostly going to talk about today is, I'll talk mainly about intestinal organoids. I'll go to in vivo, the second part of the talk. But this is has been a very long-term and very fun collaboration with a group of Prisca Liberali that's been going on for many years now, and it was started the first post in the lab, Shirley on my side, and Chutan on her side. That all of this published, so I'll go relatively fast on this. But essentially, the idea of intestinal organoids is they're very cool because they're essentially a system that you can watch break symmetry live in a petri dish. So if you take intestinal stem cells, it's going to start by making a cyst. And all of this first part, actually, Cornelia is going to talk about in the next talk. I will essentially assume that a stem cell niche has been formed. So essentially, you break symmetry and you make a domain of stem cell here. And then there's a second phase where essentially the stem cells has been formed while in green here, while the organoid is still spherical. And then you see this morphogenesis, where in the end you end up creating a big curvature, and this is exactly what the stem cells are. And this is nice because it actually recapitulates the architecture in vivo, where stem cells reside in crypts, which is the most curved region of the epithelium. And again, we were asking, okay, how do you get this robust mapping between shape and fate acquisition? Okay, so again, the nice thing with intestinal organoids is that you can look at them in live, which is very hard to do in the mouse in mouse. And so this is one of the a movie, for instance, that you can take, where you can. So this is the same organoid. This is a cross section, and this is maximum intensity projection. And again, you can see a crypt that's going to emerge here. For instance, bending here, there's another one that's going to emerge here. And we looked a lot at this movie, and to cut a long story short, one of the two components was probably one of the most sort of classical developmental event, which is apical constriction. Essentially, these organoids put a lot of actomyosin on the apical side in the crypt, and this tends to bend. They tend to bend the crypt inward, so that's a mechanism where essentially you create curvature by differential localization of actomyosin. But one thing which is kind of interesting, which turned out to be quite fruitful, is actually what we had missed, is that if you look at the volume of the lumen, the volume of the fluid that is enclosed in this thing, it's the orange curve here, it actually decays pretty drastically by 60% during exactly at the onset of clip morphogenesis. And this was a very different mechanical scenario. This looked a lot more like buckling. If you would deflate a football, of course you change the surface to area ratio, and so at some point you would make a crypt, and that's a completely different scenario to bending through apical tension. So again, these are published. So there was multiple possible components of force balance. So we needed to make a model, and for us this was very reminiscent. We often use soft matter as an inspiration for these kind of systems. And if you could look at this combination of changes in volume and changes of apical constriction of spontaneous curvature, this looks very similar to what people have done in the 90s on lipid vesicles. Essentially, if you have a domain of, on a lipid vesicle, if you have a domain of lipids that want to be curved, and you reduce, initially it cannot do it because it's too tense, but if you just remove a little bit of volume in the lumen, suddenly things become less tense, and the first thing you do is a phase transition where basically you bud and you gain all the curvature and you get all your curvature in the crypt, right? So essentially, actually, it turned out that the model we ended up doing was very similar to that. So it's something which is called a 3D vertex model, essentially generalizing the idea of foams to epithelium, which can have different tensions on their apical, lateral, and basal side. But the core idea is the same. You have a domain of stem cells that want to be curved. You have a domain of differentiated cells that doesn't. And they have to share a constant volume. So there's a natural tug of war by the fact that there's a constant and closed volume over all of this. There's a few interesting things. There's some things that are recapitulated. And as we'll see, there's some things that are new by considering these issues. And in particular, again, because this is published, so I'll go relatively fast, I'll give you the answer. Essentially, you can map all of this morphogenesis on a two-dimensional phase diagram. This here, and this is the organ morphology with, again, the stem cell crypts in red. This axis here is how much apical tension is in the crypts. So it tends to make you bud. The more you increase, the more you bud out. And this is the volume of the organoid. And actually, again, to cut a long story short, it turned out that there was a division of mechanical labor between stem and differentiated cells, where essentially all of your actomyosin was controlled by the stem cells. So the stem cells have a program that makes them put actomyosin on their apical side. But it turns out that the volume, the changes in the volume was due to differentiated cells, because essentially when cells differentiate, they upregulate some ion pumps on their apical side, and they change the osmotic balance. So essentially they end up eating up the fluid. So you change the surface to area ratio. And so essentially what we do is we have cooperation at a distance where basically the stem cells and the organoid dies a diagonal in this parameter space, where at the same time as the crypt contract, the villous cells deflate the organoid. And it turns out actually that sort of one here below one is sort of essentially no tension in the epithelium. So there's actually never buckling. The organoid starts from a state which is very swollen, where it's actually very hard to bud out. And what the differentiated cells do is essentially relax the tension in the epithelium in order to allow the stem cells to bud out. So it's kind of, again, cooperation at a distance and a division of mechanical labor. And this is an example where actually initially we're not considering feedback. Actually, we have two domains of fate, which create two domains of mechanics, which create a given geometry. But again, and I alluded to later, this doesn't really consider any active communication or any ways of buffering against noise. And this was explaining a number of things, which I'm not going to enter into this again because it's published. But there was one experiment that this theory didn't explain, and this was the subject of the next paper, which we published last year. And there was one thing which was quite surprising, is that in this phase diagram, for one set of parameter, you have one morphology. So essentially, there's just an exact mapping between the number of between the parameter value and the shape of the organoid. And there was one experiment which was pretty paradoxical, which was that the temporal order of mechanical perturbation actually mattered and changed completely the nature of the system. So basically, this is the degree of crypt opening. So 0 means it's budded, and 1 means it's open, and this is the volume of the lumen. So essentially, black is the normal morphogenesis. It's this diagonal where you start open, and as the lumen volume decreases, you start budding out. So this is normal morphogenesis. If you do an osmotic shock to keep the lumen open early on, you stay on this line and you don't bud. That makes sense. That's why I told you before, you need the lumen volume. That's exactly the same as before. You need the lumen volume decrease to detense your epithelium and to be able to bud out. What was surprising is this branch, if you do the exact same mechanical perturbation after morphogenesis, is complete, after budding it's complete, actually you don't reopen again and you can keep the organoid completely budded and that impacts. And that's kind of weird because it means that now for two exact same value of parameter sets in principle in a model, you have completely different outcomes. And that's something that was actually not, that's something essentially which is hysteresis or bistability, which was not captured in the model. And it's quite drastic. For instance, if you look at an organoid that has already budded here, you can inflate the differentiators that are crazy, and the crypts are completely insensitive to this perturbation. So that's a source of robustness, right? That means that after morphogenesis is complete, the even though crypts needed these mechanical perturbations, they seem to be able to completely buffer against them just after morphogenesis is done. And so again, this is going to have path dependence, hysteresis, whoever you want to call it, and that's a general feature of bistability, which is thought to give robustness to developmental systems. Okay, so what's the minimal assumption addition to this model to give that? Well, again, I've kind of hinted it. We just were assuming that the different domains were doing things in a completely uncorrelated manner and were not talking to each other, and that's a pretty unlikely a scenario. And in particular, we were screening for models that might work, and one thing that was quite biologically plausible, we thought, and would explain everything, would be if crypts would be mechanosensitive. And the idea behind that now is that mechanosensitive, meaning that they don't just react to stress, but they adapt their apical tension based on the stress. And why would this work? Well, essentially, if you change the volume, if your differentiated cells change the volume of the organoid, now you have two effects. You have a purely passive one, just because you're decreasing the state of stress of the tissue, but that also changes the curvature or the shape of the crypt, and that can be sensed actively by the crypt to adapt its own tension. So essentially, volume has a now dual effect, one which is passive and one which is active. And essentially, this is the way we were considering it, is that essentially there's a positive feedback loop between the curvature in the crypt and the amount of differentiated tension, which is a positive feedback loop here, which positive feedback loops is one of the simplest way you can create bistability in a system. So this is kind of the reason qualitatively why it worked. Okay, so for starters, is it true at all? Well, the cool what Sutton could do is essentially redo these kind of experiments of inflation, but with a myosin line where you can look in live at the myosin localization. And here, this is an organoid just before budding. So it has a little bit of apical myosin on the side, more apical myosin here than on the basal side. And actually, when you inflate it, not only do you lose your curvature, but you also uniformize your apical tension. Now you basically have the same amount of apical of myosin on the apical and basal side. And you can do this there's natural variability in the system, so you can do a dose response of how much the myosin is gone as a function of the amount of osmotic shock or the crypt radius, and you can parameterize your mechanosensation here as a function to describe how the apical tension changes as a function of the crypt geometry. So that shows that the mechanization we can fully parameterize with this, and the model had been parameterized otherwise from the experiments before, so we essentially had something which is parameter-free. And if you go back to the phase diagram from before, which was, again, sort of tension in the crypts versus volume in the lumen, now you have a huge region which is bistable, where basically there's two possible states that are stable, one which is open and one which is closed. And what we realized, which was kind of cool, is that it explained a little bit, essentially, all of our observations. When you do a diagonal, which is your normal form of genesis, you go from monostable open to monostable close, that's fine. If you now reopen, you enter the bistable region from the closed state, and if you enter a bistable region from the closed state, you're going to stay closed. But if you would have forced the system to operate at constant volume, then you would enter the bistable region from the open state and you would stay open. And it turns out we can do more than that. You can do washout experiments, basically, where you can take closed scripts. You can take scripts that are closed here. You can both do an osmotic shock and blebestatin to take you here, for instance, and you indeed open. Then you can wash out only the blebestatin, but not the osmotic shock. And then you do this, and you stay open as you predict. And then you can wash out the blebestatin, and then you go back to budded, essentially. So you can sort of play jump rope with this phase diagram, and things seem to work. So that's quantitative. That's more on the quantitative side. But to close on this first part of the talk, what we found is at a more conceptual level, is that we have a positive feedback loop in crypts, which is mechanosensitive, which together with collective mechanics essentially gives rise to a really, really large region of bistability. And that means essentially that you can use, that you essentially have an irreversible transition where organoid budding is controlled by volume, but essentially you have an absorbing state where once the morphogenesis is done, you're completely robust to that to the mechanical perturbation that took you there. And it's a way at the collective level to do irreversible transitions, which we think is quite robust. And I think this is, in a way, this bistability here really comes at the level of tissues. And we find it nice because it's, in a way, of very equivalent to the robustness of fate choices, right? If you, this is a very nice work that has been looking at sort of bistability of fate choices in Drosophila. The idea, right, if you take a stem cell and you put a differentiation factor on top of it, it's going to differentiate. Once you remove the differentiation factor, the cells are not going to go back to its stem cell state, right? And people interpret that through the fact that at some point you're bistable, and therefore you only need transient stimulation of something to take you to a robust state. And what we think is essentially going on here is we have the same amount of bistability at the mechanochemical level, and that enables you sort of irreversible shape transitions. Okay. So this is first part of the talk. Now I'll get to unpublished stuff. And there was essentially two sets of questions that we wanted to ask next. One, which is that we've shown phenomenologically that there were this kind of mechanosensitive feedback in the system, but we had no idea where they came from and what were the cells actually sensing. And the other thing is that this was purely on organoids, and whether these kind of findings translate to in vivo, which is non-trivial because it's an open tube, right? So this question of like lumen pressure and lumen volume are not necessarily translate one-to-one. So the first thing about how feedbacks are mechanically encoded, initially in the theory, we had put in that it was essentially sensing curvature. And this was based on a set of paper, including one which we did with the group of Sylvain Gabrielli, and also work from Matthias Lutov's group, which are quite nice, where you impose curvature on a system. So the problem with developmental systems is that they both create their curvature and respond to curvature, but you can take bioengineering approach where essentially you make substrate with defined curvature that cannot change, and then you put cells on it. And then you can answer the reverse part of that feedback. Are cells able to tell whether they're in a mountain or a valley? And it turns out that they do. So basically, the most relevant here is maybe this work from Matthias Lutov because it's on intestinal organoids, so it's exactly the cells that we're looking at. And if you look at stem cell markers, you can see that essentially stem cells light up preferentially in the regions of highest curvature and less in the regions of low curvature. So this says somehow that cells are able to sense directly their curvature, but again, we have no idea of how this happens. So this is actually some work that Paul Robin did in my group as a postdoc. Now he's a researcher in Institut Curie. And essentially, he wanted to test different ideas about what cells actually measure and what's the importance for that. And so the first thing he did was really something that we thought would be the most boring thing ever. It was designed to work. We just redid exactly the same simulation as before, but just single cell resolution. Before, what we were assuming in this model is that every stem cell in the crypt were exactly the same, and every differentiated cell were the same, so we were coarse graining the entire thing. And now we just wanted to do a vertex model, which is actually cell resolved, where every cell has a degree of freedom to sense its own curvature and react. And again, we thought it would be exactly the same because we were putting exactly the same ingredient in a model. Basically, essentially, briefly, cells have apical, basal, and lateral tensions, and the core ingredient here is that they're able to sense their local curvature. So their apical tension has a genetically encoded baseline, which is constant, plus something where they constantly adapt to their own single-cell curvature. And again, this is exactly the same model as before, just cell resolved. So we thought this would start from this and this would curve inwards, and it failed miserably. Essentially, it was making this kind of weird shapes that were completely unable to globally shape. And initially, we thought it was an artifact and it was sort of a little bit boring, but it turned out that he did a lot of simulation, he did a lot of continuum theory on this, and it turned out that it's actually a fundamental problem in the system that we hadn't realized. And the problem with this is that actually it's a little bit similar. It actually brought this idea of competitiveness in mechanics in a way we hadn't thought about. Is essentially it's a little bit similar to a prisoner's dilemma. What you want as an end product is that you want everyone to curve. So you want every cell to curve at the same amount but again, there's a positive feedback loop in each of them. The problem is that being able to bend all together means a cooperation, means that everyone should sort of curve together. But actually, it turns out that one of the simplest ways for a single cell to curve is to steal curvature from its neighbor, basically, to essentially do this kind of fate where one cell out of two has stolen all of the curvature of its neighbor. Essentially, in sort of in the language of ecology, this is competition for a finite resource. You can see that if you look at the energy landscape of two cells. So essentially, these are two cells that are non-curved. These are two cells that are curved. And this is actually two cells being curved equally is the global minimum of the system. But it turns out that actually there's like local minimas where essentially one cell has stolen all of the curvature of the other. And the problem is that it's kinetically favorable, essentially. So if you start from simulations like this, it turns out it's much easier for a cell to steal all the curvature from its neighbor and not create global curvature rather than sort of to cooperate. And essentially, this is a problem. I mean, this is really the problem of kinetically selected modes versus the thermodynamically realistic one. You can try to improve, but there's a problem where curvature sensing is fundamentally competitive because, again, the simplest way of getting curvature and sort of reinforcing your own biases is to steal it from its neighbors. So how do you deal with this? So it turns out that actually, initially, we had not really considered this. The other possibility is that cells don't sense curvature, they sense their local density. And initially, we thought it was exactly the same, because actually, just geometrically, if you bend something, you're also going to make it sort of, in this kind of vertex model, if you create curvature, you're also going to make cells denser in that region. It's just some geometrical thing. So essentially, when the cell is curved, it tends to be more dense anyway, so we thought it would be exactly the same. But it turned out, actually, if you now say that cells increase their apical tension as a function of their local sensing, even though, again, the final state is exactly the same, it's completely different. The simulations work really nicely, and every cell cooperates for free into having the same curvature. And the reason for this is, again, when you sense your density, for instance, essentially when one cell starts apically constricting, it becomes tall. But as you become tall, the simplest way you do is you bring your neighbors with you. You essentially pull out, you essentially lift off your neighbors. And again, in an ecological perspective, if you do the theory, it turns out that sort of 2D density or essentially sharing a lateral edge means sort of it's essentially a facilitative interaction. It's something which is a shared resource, and the simplest way of getting taller is to bring your neighbors to be taller with you because they're connected essentially. So even though again the final state is exactly the same, if you think about it in terms of single cells that read their local information and adapt to each other, there's one where you get fundamentally trapped into competitive minimas, and one where you very naturally converge towards the global minimum, which we found to be quite interesting. This is at a single cell level. It turned out actually when we were thinking about now at different scales of the scale and entire crypt, you had exactly the same problem that kept popping up and up. If you think about in vivo now, we studied mainly organoids that had a single crypt, but if you look at in vivo, you're gonna have a problem because there's many crypts that need to emerge next to each other, right? This is an in vivo where you've patterned a bunch of crypts. And there's a fundamental problem with this that is essentially when a crypt starts budding, it's going to remove a lot of area. It's going to if a crypt starts budding out, it's going to remove area from the total epithelium, basically. So you're going to put everything under tension. And again, if we were doing models of that, you would have this kind of thing, sort of early bird gets the worm thing, where essentially the first two crypts that have budded tend to stretch the tissue and tend to essentially devoid the resources of the last crypt. Where again, mechanics will not be cooperative. Mechanics will tend to make you diverge and to make you more and more divergent, essentially, because you're competing for a certain resource. So given this, we were actually really interested of going back in vivo and looking both at the single cell scale and the tissue scale. How do cells actually manage to navigate converging towards stereotypical shapes? And this is the work of a PhD student, Clara, and a postdoc, Laura, again in Prisca's lab, that they did with Paul. And the question that they asked, that we asked in this project specifically, that is still ongoing, is how do interacting crypts in vivo coordinate their morphogenesis towards a uniform morphology? So this essentially is a winner-takes-all kind of scenario. One possibility is that it happens, basically. What the crypts that we're seeing are the survivors. And essentially, that you start from variability, and at some point you kill off the ones that sort of are too weird, and you end up And you end up essentially, and that's why you end up being reproducible. So what Laura did is to do a very detailed time course of in vivo crude morphogenesis, essentially sort of measuring a bunch of features of their crypt. So here you can see they're not very budded initially, and then they're going to bud out. And what was cool, and what we saw both actually in vivo here and in organoids, is that we really don't see divergence, we really see convergence. Essentially, early on, if you look in morpho space, essentially a PCA, that a principal component analysis that takes into account cell, crypt shapes, what you see is that initially there's many different shapes of crypts, but they tend to actually all converge towards a common feature. So not only is there no divergence in the system, but there's actually really convergence. And you end up with crypts that, if you look at their variance or their budding index, essentially are extremely reproducible, and which is what people have many over and over observed, right? If you look at the mature intestine, every crypt looks exactly the same and can be superposed one on top of the other. But it turns out that's not the case, actually, if you look earlier on, which again suggests, especially given I told you, that there's really some active mechanisms that is sensing. So again, the first question is, okay, everything we did was on organoids. Can we translate it to in vivo? It turns out yes, because essentially what goes on is that in organoids, it was a competition between crypt apical tension and osmotic effects from the lumen. It turns out that actually these osmotic effects come from differentiated cells swelling up, essentially taking up the fluid, and that still happens in vivo. Essentially, what happens in vivo is that your crypts have apical constriction, and your differentiated cells tend to swell as well. We also observe it in vivo. So there you have the same idea, where essentially differentiated cells start providing compressive forces by their swelling, and that helps reduce the tissue tension and allowing the crypts to bud. So you can have very similar simulations adapted to in vivo. And again, if we don't do any mechanosensing, we have the exact problem, but that's in a mathematical way that I showed before, is that if you start modeling two crypts now which are adjacent, and you make them a tiny bit different at the start, you will have essentially winner-takes-all kind of scenario, where essentially either both crypts are open, both crypts are closed if you put parameters to an extreme state, but there's a huge region of parameter space where you essentially have divergent outcome, where you have winner-takes-all. Essentially, one crypt has stolen all the curvature from its neighbor through sort of mechanical competition. So again, how does this happen? Well, what I've told you before is that this was without any mechanosensing, and essentially what we found, to cut a long story short, is that you can restore convergence, you can make cells catch up with each other, but you need, again, density sensing, crypt density sensing. So you need an active sensing mechanism, and it's required to be density, because I've shown you curvature doesn't work. Curvature is fundamentally problematic. So this gave quite a few sort of cue on what's going on, and again, conceptually, what we think is going on in the system is that if you want to coordinate at the multicellular level different structures, you need two things. You need a common signal, and what we think here is that is the villous swell cells swelling everywhere, and you need a signal processing unit, and you need the right one, which is in this context density sensing in crypts. So again, are these two ingredients correct? So actually, I'm not going to show it, but villous swelling, yes, we found it exactly, we think, with similar regulators as in vitro. Essentially ion pumps. But the question is, how do you sense specifically density? So then Laura looked at some single-cell sequencing, and essentially looking, the way to do it is to essentially, because you have a stereotypical axis from crypt to differentiated cells, you can essentially look at known mechanosensors that are expressed specifically in a crypt. And one of the most interesting ones that showed up was CPLA2. And CPLA2 has been studied over the last decade. It's quite interesting. It sort of releases arachidonic acid, which activates contractility, especially when internal membranes are compressed. People have studied it quite a bit for nuclear mechanosensing, and it's known to be associated with cortex contractility. So here I'm going to cut a long story short. Sort of Laura did a lot of experiments on this, but essentially it was a very promising thing because, one, it was expressed, CPLA2 was expressed in crypts so it was in the right time and the right place, both in vivo and in vitro. If you change density by hyper or hypoosmotic shocks, it adapts in a way that you predict, which is good. Again, the problem in organoids is that when you change the osmotic shock, you change both the density and the curvature, which is which is a bit complex, but you can also plate these organoids on flat substrates to make them essentially 2D, so you essentially abrogate the curvature, and in this context, you can see that actually CPLA2 reacts to the 2D density of monolayers, so it seems to be a density sensor. And not only that, but if you inhibit CPLA2 In organoids, you see that you decrease contractility. So essentially, and again, there's many more data in there, but essentially it was exactly the type of sensor we were working on. It controls apical contractility in crypts, it senses mechanics, and it seems to sense specifically 2D density rather than curvature. Okay, so this was nice. So then we could make essentially a prediction for robustness, and then we went back to organoids, which is actually a bit harder to test in vitro. But essentially, whereas before we were always concentrated on the organoids with a single crypt, we now specifically looked at organoids that had multiple crypts to be able to look at the variability between different crypts. And essentially what we found is that in controls, in a model, the two crypts converge exactly to the same output, because again, you have both a global signal, which is your osmotic changes, plus a sensor that is plus the correct sensor. But actually, if you break, if you remove either the sensor, if you remove the sensor by inhibiting CPLA2, or if you inhibit the upstream factor by inhibiting osmotic shocks, essentially what you predict in the model is divergent morphogenesis, that you should reveal the competitive nature of morphogenesis, where essentially one crypt is going to win and going to remove all of the curvature from the other. And so essentially, the model predicts that you have either competitive mechanics or sort of cooperative and canalizing mechanics as a function of the conditions. And essentially, these are exactly the same experiments. And what was cool is that, again, in control, you end up having crypts that are very similar shapes, but either, either by inhibiting swelling or by inhibiting sensing, you end up having like very divergent shapes. So here you have very divergent shapes, both in this case, and this is a rescue of CPA2 when you do actinic acid, and you also rescue your shape, which is quite nice. So essentially, this was very much validating that there's a fundamental problem in morphogenesis where you tend to fundamentally become competitive and divergent. Because essentially you have a shared resource, which is tension in the epithelium, and you need to mitigate it, and we through this kind of feedback loop. Okay, I'm actually done. It's 35 minutes, so I will essentially stop here. The last thing that Laura did recently is so far actually the inhibition of CPLA2 was through an inhibitor, so it is an organoid, but she also generated CPLA2 knockout in mice, and it's conditional. Otherwise, the mice is going to have problems. And essentially, what you found, which is quite nice, is that even in vivo, actually, the crypts which are CPLA2 knockout tend to be sort of much more variable than the other ones and tend to stay open, actually. So we're still analyzing this dataset in detail. In particular, we're looking at sort of spatial-temporal correlation between these crypts, but it's quite promising, showing that actually also in vivo you can reproduce some of the features that we've shown in organoids. So essentially, the working model we have now for in vivo is that there's a fundamental competition for space at the level of crypts, because when they bud, they remove area from the system. Essentially, you have a shared organizer, which is the villus, which provides a global signal by having osmotic changes. This applies sort of compressive forces on all of the crypts that depend on that villus. This is sensed by CPLA2, which is a density sensing mechanism that is fundamentally cooperative, and that enables essentially sort of active convergence of crypts next to each other. So this is basically over. I want to thank my group. I want to thank in particular Cholet and Paul as well, the project that did everything on this, and the group of Prisca, who did all of the experiments that we talk about. And thank you very much for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.